Tuesday, September 11th, 2007, upon further review, episode number 46. This week we tackle rockers, secret agents, and obsessive dog walkers. It may not seem like there's much connecting these three groups, and there's only one other group I can think of which can bring them all together. The Reviewers, bringing disparate elements into congenial harmony. Okay, upon further review, I'm Greg.
I'm Clea.
And this is episode number 46. This is going to be getting out to you much sooner than the delay between our last couple of shows, because things have now stabilized with the beginning of the semester for me and with Clea's work, and so yeah. So it's all been locked down. So we want to thank everyone for listening as usual and for checking us out. And we want to make just a couple notations before we get started on the show itself. First of all, I got an email from a friend of mine, Tiffany, who I don't know if she even listens to this show, to be honest, but she had sent an email out about IKEA, and since we reviewed IKEA before, we thought it was only fair to mention the fact that, according to this article that she found, IKEA construction developers are building an IKEA home furnishing store in Nanjing, and their excavators and bulldozers have apparently chopped off the tops of the 1,800-year-old tombs that were in China. So it says the destruction of ancient tombs is illegal in China, but sometimes developers prefer to pay the fines and proceed with construction. IKEA has not released a comment at this time. So, Clea, do you have any thoughts about this company that you've defended as being good? And
I don't think I've defended it as being good
and wonderful and protects babies.
No, I mean, we definitely need puppies to look into this. I mean, part of the difficulty is how much oversight the officials of actually IKEA had and how much delegating they did to local Chinese authorities, because if they delegated to local Chinese authorities, that was their first mistake, because Chinese authorities are not going to care about much. But
except
we'll need to
money.
See if they did know about it, then that's a big concern, and when we might have to change our rating, Greg.
Which would be shocking, and I don't know if we've ever done that
would
on this show.
That
would
be UFR first.
So IKEA, if you're listening, you better, if you understand the gravity of the
right
situation that you've placed yourself in. So to avoid that, we think it's very important that you respond immediately and positively. So we want to thank Tiffany for that.
We don't want them to lie, though, just simply to not affect their rating on UFR.
Well,
so you have to tell the truth.
Yes.
But, you know,
I mean, you need to respond positively by saying, this is a terrible thing and we are going to rebuild the tombs.
Okay.
Or, you know, something like that. You know, because, and then just say, like, brought to you by UFR's
positive rating. Well, actually, also in the picture in that article, it had the picture of the, what's the name of that tomb with all the different soldiers?
Tomb of the Unknown Soldier? I don't know.
No. Well, I don't know the name of the tomb, but it's the tomb of where there's all those terracotta soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
And when my dad and I went and saw that tomb, there's a few different companies there where you can buy replicas.
Oh, really?
And so we bought a smaller replica and had it shipped to our house. And we made sure, saying, please, please don't have it arrive until this date, because we were in China for a while and we knew that if it arrived early, you know, people would know we weren't there and might do something to our house. Unfortunately, it did arrive early and queued off people, I guess, to our house being vacant, and hence our house was robbed.
All because you sent a replica
of a terracotta soldier.
And the Chinese said that they would not send it, and they did, of course.
Right. And to top it all off, it was destroyed in the shipping.
That's a really sad story.
Yeah, so maybe these tombs deserve to be destroyed.
All right, well, that's our show. I don't even know where to go from there. High energy, hey! And then the show, that was bad. Okay, well, yeah, I don't know. So, anyway, our point is, IKEA, you're on watch, you're on notice, and so you better make sure that you make good.
Orange warning.
So thanks for sending that along. And then the other thing we wanted to mention was, tonight, we are going to be reviewing, as usual, three things, but one of the things that we're reviewing, finally, is something which was sent to us back in early August, actually. A guy whose name is Ben, who is 12 years old. I think I may have read this on a previous email,
mm-hmm.
but he said that we do a great show, thank you, and we do a particularly good job at varying the types of things we review, and he said that we'd only reviewed one piece of music in the history of your show, which is actually not true. We've reviewed a few different things of music, but not enough. So he sent us some CDs to review, and so this week we're going to be taking on Bruce Springsteen, and so we wanted to thank Ben for the request.
We'll probably do one other from the list that he gave us.
Yes.
Because he gave us, six or something.
He gave us five or six. We'll probably do another one as well, but just in advance, Ben, thank you for sending that information, and for everyone else for doing that as well. Mm-hmm. So. All right, so let's get started with the show today. And we've got, as I said, three things we're going to review. We're going to start by reviewing Bruce Springsteen. And specifically, we're going to review Greetings from Asbury Park, which was his first album. It was something which was requested by our friend Ben. And we're also going to use it as an opportunity to talk a little bit about Bruce Springsteen overall, because he's just about to release a new album, the song for which, with great fanfare, he has released for free. You know, if I see one more of these artists patting themselves on the back because they release something on iTunes for free, and you go over there and you have to sign up for 6,000 email addresses and, you know, 500 newsletter subscriptions just so that you can get one freaking song. But
the song is called Craig.
I know, right? But the song is called Radio Nowhere. So we're going to have a chance to talk a little bit about Bruce Springsteen's career and a little bit of a retrospective, I guess. Then we're going to move on to talk about a movie which Clea and I have been wanting to see for a long time and finally did, The Bourne Ultimatum. We've finally seen it, and we will report upon that. And then finally, we're going to conclude by reviewing a podcast. This was submitted to us for review by the person who does the podcast, and the name of the podcast is Amanda Banana, Obsessive Dog Walker Video Podcast. Yes,
right.
It may sound a little odd, but that's exactly what it is. And she is actually married, I will say, to the guy who plays Dove on the Hawk and Dove podcast that we reviewed last week. So this is a family affair,
right?
Basically. And, you know, Clea and I are a family affair as well. So really, it's a family-friendly show.
On to Bruce Springsteen.
Okay, speaking of families. You can find this information at brucespringsteen.net. That is the official Bruce Springsteen website. And we wanted to start by talking a little bit about Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, which was Bruce Springsteen's first album, and it was released in 1973. And it actually is Greetings from Asbury Park, NJ, if you want the full title of the album. And they decided to record the album at a very low-priced studio to save as much as possible of the CBS advance and to cut the record in a single week. And it sold about 25,000 copies in the first year. I guess a couple things that we'd want to say about this, first of all, and Bruce Springsteen generally is, I mean, when I think about Bruce Springsteen, I think about a rock artist who is uniquely New Jersey, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my relatives who live in New Jersey love Bruce Springsteen. They cannot get enough. And Bruce Springsteen could sell out, you know, the Meadowlands from now until, you know, 2500. I mean, Bruce Springsteen's great-great-great-great-grandson could sell out, you know, the Meadowlands.
Right.
Because he has, in a lot of ways, really captured the New Jersey imagination. But, of course, Springsteen's become a big international act as well, touring all over the world and everything else. But when I think about him, I think of this guy as kind of a uniquely New Jersey artist.
Yeah.
My general thought.
Although when you hear him talk, he sounds country.
Well, yeah, he's gotten
he has
more
this
that
weird
way.
Accent.
Yeah, he's gotten more that way. He's kind of bluegrassy, I guess I would say.
It's kind of an odd thing.
This album was originally released, as I said, in 1973, and was with the first album of he and the E Street Band. And Springsteen recorded most of his famous albums with the E Street Band, and then sometime in the, I guess I want to say the early 90s or late 80s, maybe broke up with the E Street Band for a while and just went single. Let me just say in a quick tangent, I've never understood why artists feel the need to go solo when the band is called them. It's like,
well,
Dave Matthews is my favorite example of this, right? The Dave Matthews Band, and then he went solo.
You're
the Dave Matthews Band. Why do you need to go solo to be the Dave? Because
it,
the
it
band
really
was too much, you know?
It really is quite silly, but it is something that speaks to the fact that maybe these bands do actually play quite a big role, or a significant role, let's say, in the writing of the songs, and therefore the fact that he decides that it is different to go out and break from these bands speaks to, I guess, that he wants to do something without their influence. Otherwise, why would you change? Why would you go out on your own?
I guess. But it just seems strange to me that they wouldn't have the most creative control in a band which has their name. I mean, I guess...
You want to try, you know, playing with other people and seeing how that influences your art.
Well, you can do that, but could you put your ego to the side enough so you don't have to name yourself? It also doesn't have to be your solo work. I mean, like, for example, when Roy Orbison decided that he wanted to do some stuff, Roy Orbison went and recorded with a band called the Traveling Wilburys, and nobody would have known that that band had Roy Orbison and I think some dude from the Pretenders, and it had Tom Petty and Bob Dylan. None of those people had the say this is the Tom Petty band or the Bob Dylan band or the Roy Orbison band, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I wonder a little bit about that. But anyway, but then he got back together with the E Street Band, and obviously Springsteen has been an enormous success, selling, you know, multi-platinum albums. I think he's already been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's been, you know, an enormous force on the rock scene. Probably his most famous album is the Born to Run album, and the song Born to Run is considered one of the, you know, top songs of all time and is very well done. But there's a lot of good stuff off of that. Thunder Road comes off of that album. Jungle Land is off of that album. So there's a lot of good stuff as well. But on the Asbury Park album, which was his first, he did a few songs which may surprise you. The album opens up with Blinded by the Light. And if you've heard the more famous version by Manfred Mann, that's the one that's, you know, Blinded by the Light. Uh-huh. Wrapped up like a whatever it is, and then I never remember the next line.
It sounds like wrapped up in a douche.
Yeah, which I don't think that's what it is.
No, it's not. But that's what it sounds like.
But Bruce Springsteen wrote that, which I couldn't believe that he was the first one to write that. They actually remade his song. And they have, you know, I'm looking at Wikipedia here reluctantly, but they have the first line of some of these songs. So the first line of Blinded by the Light is Madmen, drummers, bummers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. No wonder clearly that's...
Well, when you listen to Blinded by the Light by Springsteen, it sounds nothing.
That's true.
Like, I mean, it
really
is... Well,
Manfred Mann overproduces it, right? His version is very
produced. Well, whatever, but it is a remake. You know how sometimes the remakes are, why did you do it? It sounds exactly like it. This really is like an entire remake of them interpreting it however they want to interpret the song. So it sounds like a completely different song.
Yep, that's true. But it's interesting that he came up with a kind of lyric quality. I was sort of impressed with that. My problem with with Springsteen's lyric writing is that he's very erratic. I think some of his lyric writing is really excellent, and some of it is kind of like, eh. I mean, you know, so I just mentioned the Blinded by the Light one, right? First line of Does This Bus Stop at 82nd Street, which I think is the fourth song off of that album. Hey, bus driver, keep the change, bless your children, give them names. And then there's other lyrics like Interstellar Mongrel Nymphs, Mary Lou Rides to Heaven on a Gyroscope. I mean, what? And there's no real coherency between, you know, from one line to the next. Now, there have certainly been other songs that have been written that are, you know, incomprehensible lyrically. But it seems to me that a lot of Springsteen's music isn't complicated enough or complex enough to compensate for weird lyric writing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like, oh, well, the lyrics are not that good, but the music is so well put together. You know, his music tends to be fairly straight ahead. Sometimes it's more, there's a kind of rawness to Springsteen's writing and even to his voice.
Right.
And when he's at his best, as in a song like Born to Run, which is, as I said, not on this album, when he's at his best, that rawness contributes to this sense that you're listening to an artist who's real, you know, who really emotionally feels what he's singing.
Right. And I have to say that to just go on a tangent, that segues perfectly into my overall comment, which is I don't really see Springsteen as a musician that I want to listen to his records. He is someone you want to go and see. Because when I hear his song from a record, it sounds very plain. They all sound the same, pretty mundane. Can't really hear many of the words that he's saying. But then when you see that same song live, it's a completely different song.
Right.
Partially because of what he is a good musician, so he plays with the song. And then he also is a great performer. He really performs the song.
Yeah.
And it's just an entirely different experience. So for me, Bruce Springsteen was always an artist that you have to go see.
Yeah.
A lot of his songs I really don't find all that interesting. And honestly, I never really knew much about Springsteen until you see his videos, and then you're like, oh my God, this guy's great. But then you hear his songs by themselves and you're like, okay, what? Maybe that was just one great song. And then you see another song live and you're like, oh my God. So that's just kind of my opinion that I've always felt about Springsteen. But
yeah, no, I agree. I think Springsteen is very much an artist that doesn't translate well to the studio. There are artists who are the opposite, by the way.
Right.
If you listen to, let's say, Steely Dan did most of their stuff in studio. And, you know, they're okay live, but it doesn't have the same feel. You really need to get some of the studio production to get it to work. Now, again, there are some songs that are more produced than others. In fact, when we talk about Radio Nowhere, we're going to talk about a song which really is more produced. But I think Springsteen really is at his best when he has that kind of live feel. And I think that his stuff doesn't record particularly well to the studio. I've always put Springsteen, honestly, kind of in the John Mellencamp category. He's a person that a lot of people like, and I've always, at least in Mellencamp's case, I've always been kind of like, eh, you know, like, there are a few songs of his that are okay. Springsteen's better, don't get me wrong. Springsteen's clearly better than Mellencamp, but there are some things, I just have never really been that overwhelmed with Mellencamp, and I feel similarly in many ways about Springsteen. I think he's a good writer. I think he has moments that are really lyrically excellent, not just the Born to Run song. There are later songs like that as well. For example, Philadelphia, which was written, you know, which was a theme to the movie Philadelphia,
right,
is a very well done song, and it kind of is Springsteen at its best. It's
right.
Sparse, it's you know, it's sort of pure,
right,
and it allows his emotive voice to come through.
Right.
So I think Springsteen clearly has talent. There's no question about it, and he's got staying power. He certainly is a, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame type guy.
Right.
I just don't know whether the songs are the ones that really stand out for me in particular. You know, if you listen to the Beatles and listen to Sgt. Pepper's, that's just one great song after the other. You know, For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, and I'm, you know, I'm Fixing a Hole, and Wednesday Morning at 9 o'clock, and A Day in the Life, and, you know, Sgt. Pepper's itself. And I mean, it's just all of these great songs, one after the other. And I don't really ever get the feeling when you listen to an album of Springsteen that you're just like, yes, dog, next song. Oh, great, next song.
Right.
And it's similar here with Asbury Park. You know, Blinded by the Light is something which we've already mentioned now. Growing Up is okay. Mary Queen of Arkansas was okay. I already mentioned Does This Bus Stop at 82nd Street. Lost in the Flood I thought was nice. It's a song about a Vietnam War veteran. And it's prettier and more lyrical and kind of slower. I like that. You know, then it's hard to be a saint in the city. This is an example. That's the closing song on this album. I'm looking again just here briefly in Wikipedia. So it says the lyrics are about a youth growing up in the streets of a city who's trying to stay good and do what he believes is right. Now, when I listened to this song, I don't know what your experience was like, Clea, but I didn't get the weight of that lyric from the music that was being written around it. I mean,
you listen to song after song on the CD, at least for me, the music sounds the same.
Yeah.
But then when you see each of these different songs live, like, you know, a perfect example is listen to the CD, then go to YouTube and listen to each of the, watch a video of each of the songs
being done live and
being done live, and you will see these are all different songs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when you listen on the CD one after the other, it kind of all sound the same.
Yep, absolutely. But apparently a lot of other people have been deeply influenced by it. David Bowie recorded It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City Again, and obviously we mentioned Manfred Mann re-recording Blinded by the Light.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people were definitely influenced by what Springsteen was doing, and I do think that what Springsteen was able to communicate effectively was that kind of emotive quality of his voice. Springsteen doesn't have a great voice, but it's a true voice, and it's a voice that clearly represents him. There's very little fake or overproduced about Springsteen.
Right.
In fact, I would argue that when Springsteen lost his way a little bit in the 80s is when he was getting into these overproduced kinds of songs. I mean, like, you know, okay, Born in the USA, it's okay, but I mean, if you think about that, you know, Born in the U, and the drum beat is like, you know, there's no energy, there's no real life to that song. And I mean, it's okay, but it just is very much kind of pop specific.
What's the title of Can't Start the Fire?
Dancing in the Dark.
Dancing in the Dark. That was the one with Courtney Cox or whatever.
Can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire, even if we're just dancing in the dark. And that's the same thing. You know, it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah, it's kind of the 80s thing now.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, some people managed to escape that. Not everyone got sucked in. So that leads us to Radio Nowhere, which is the song that he's just released. And I thought it was interesting, and it was one of the reasons I suggested to Clea that we choose the Springsteen out of the ones Ben sent us, because Radio Nowhere is from his new album that's coming out. And it's very... I don't know what you thought about it, I think it's sort of more produced than a lot of his previous albums have been, with the exception maybe those 80s albums. And I don't know whether that works for him or not, to be honest with you. The producer of it, I believe, is the guy who produced a lot of the Pearl Jam albums. And it sounds much more like that than it does, you know, his sort of raw Asbury Park album type stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it sounds equally as produced as Philadelphia.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Yep.
I mean, I think that he's going along with, like, a lot of artists when you have that one main single that is produced. And yes, in some respects, it does sound...
I beg your pardon. His album is called Magic, and the single is Radio Nowhere, so...
Right. I mean, it's a little bit more upbeat than, obviously, Philadelphia, but otherwise, I think that the production quality is about the same. The style, I think, of songwriting and of lyricism is about the same. So I don't think actually, I mean, it's definitely different than his, you know, stuff in the 70s and 80s and 90s. I guess 70s and 80s. I mean, it's a little bit closer to the 90s stuff.
Right.
That's when Philadelphia came out, right?
Yeah, I guess that was early 90s, actually.
Yeah.
And I should mention, you know, of course, his last album was this album, The Rising, which was about 9/11. Now, interestingly, we're actually recording this on 9/11.
Right.
And, you know, the one thing I was thinking about with that was, I hate to say this, and this may not come across as the most popular thing to say, but, you know, if you're going to be a guy who comes out and says, you know, a lot of people said Springsteen needed to write The Rising because it was, you know, New York needed him at that time. If New York really needed him, do you think he could have maybe donated the profits to something rather than taking a big chunk of it for himself? If it was really that important to him to have, you know, this to have some big September 11th tribute, you think he could maybe have taken all of what he earned and sort of given it to somebody else? I know he didn't, because there were jokes made about it all over the place.
Oh.
About the fact that,
I mean,
he donated some of it, and I'm not saying that he needs to, you know, devote his life to becoming a, you know, a charity worker, but I have a little bit of a problem basing a whole song upon what happened on this terrible day, and, you know, everyone talking about how he saved New York, and then he goes out and, you know, makes tons, you know, millions of dollars on this album off of this tragedy. I'm sorry.
Well, I think another aspect to the joke is a lot of different artists came out with songs about it, and his really didn't stand out, I think, all that much. It wasn't a very strong album.
But again, you talk to my relatives, this is amazing. It's the greatest thing you ever wrote.
Well, yeah, because there's certain artists that resonate with certain people, and he does that.
People live in New Jersey.
People, and for those people, yes, they probably did need him to cathartically put to music the feelings for them.
That's fair enough.
So that's great.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't necessarily disagree that he probably didn't need to take very much of the cut, since he's probably a million.
I think he's got a money already, yeah. So what do you want to say for a rating? Let's say a rating, first of all, for Greetings from Asbury Park.
You know, it is tough. I can see how music is going to be a little bit tough, especially when we are reviewing things that are older, you know,
right.
Because it's definitely a 70s album.
And it got listed, you know, in the top 500 albums of all time by Billboard, yeah.
Oh, okay, well.
But hey, we don't have to listen to them.
I mean, because again, it's an album.
Yeah.
And we're not reviewing the Greetings from Asbury Park live album. We're reviewing the album that he released.
Yep.
I mean, six?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. I think a six is probably right. And now, what about Springsteen as an artist?
As an artist?
I would probably have to give him a seven.
Yeah,
I think it's not fair to give him lower than seven. I mean, some of his stuff isn't my cup of tea, but it's just not my cup of tea. It has nothing to do with him as an artist. And the one thing I will say for him is that he hasn't really, quote, sold out, from what I can tell. I mean, leaving aside what I said about The Rising and about my issues with that,
mm-hmm.
he hasn't sold out as an artist. I mean, he hasn't
jumped the shark.
No. I mean, he's the same kind of artist that he was previously,
yeah.
despite the producing of his songs or whatever. It's a little different.
Yeah.
But he still gives a great live performance. And
right.
he still is that same kind of artist who hasn't radically remade himself into
right.
some kind of pop guy. Like that's not really Springsteen's deal. So I would say a seven for Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
So a six for Greetings from Asbury Park, a seven for Bruce Springsteen, and thanks to Ben for the suggestion on that.
All right.
Okay, next we move on to the Bourne Ultimatum.
They can't stop me.
Pamela Landy.
I hear you're still looking for me.
Tracing this.
Coming online.
Trace is confirmed and valid.
On the street.
Jason Bourne.
He's within 1,000 yards of this building.
He's communicating.
Then we should communicate back.
I'm going out there.
Get the vehicles. We're going mobile. Follow Landy.
She leads us to Jason Bourne.
We need to find him and we need to take him out.
Three teams, Alpha, Bravo. Look sharp.
Where is he, people?
Noah Vosum.
This is Jason Bourne.
I was wondering when you were going to make this call.
Perhaps we can arrange a meet.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
And this is the third movie in the trilogy, the Bourne trilogy, that began with the Bourne Identity and then went to the Bourne Supremacy and now the Bourne Ultimatum. As our friend Russ says, it's like, you know, the Bourne Inconsistency, the Bourne Unbelievability.
Right. All based on books.
Yes. Originally written by the spy book writer Robert Ludlum, who's very well known for doing spy thrillers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this whole series of books about Jason Bourne.
Right. You can go to the website if you want, www.thebourneultimatum.th. Bourneultimatum.com. And you'll see Matt Damon and his I'm on the move.
Yes, I'm running.
Things out.
That's right. For those of you who don't know a lot about the whole sequence of these movies, Jason Bourne is a, I won't spoil it for you, except I can tell you that he's a secret agent, basically. He's an agent who worked for the CIA. And in the Bourne Identity, he doesn't know who he is or why he has all this. He has, like, incredible abilities. He's, you know, an incredible fighter, and he has incredible observation skills, and he speaks, you know, five languages, and he you know, knows how to get into, like, hack into computers and do all this technical stuff. So he's basically this unbelievable secret agent. But he doesn't remember anything about why he's the secret agent or who trained him or anything like that. And the three-movie arc basically traces out his discovering who he is, why he was trained, what led him to do all the things that he did, and basically brings you from one step to the other. Now, the interesting thing about this movie is, in The Bourne Identity, you know, he knows very little about himself. You know, he figures out the agent thing pretty early, but he has no idea why he was trained or any of those things.
Right.
The Bourne Supremacy, he finds out more about it. By the time you get to The Bourne Ultimatum, the third movie, you already know basically the deal about, you know, who trained him in the program and all this kind of stuff that he's involved in.
He just wants to figure out the origins.
He just wants to find out the origins. So some of the novelty of it, I guess, could have worn off. However, I think they did such a good job in a lot of ways in making the movie so interesting and in making his character so interesting that I didn't, in a way, almost notice, as I was afraid I was going to, the lack of novelty. You know, it wasn't like I was looking at it going, yeah, but I already know how this turns out.
No, because there's still a lot of the origins that we don't know, Greg.
Right.
We still don't know a lot of the specifics about how they trained him and that kind of stuff.
So, that's true.
And that does come out in this movie.
Yeah.
And there is the aspect, too, of within the three that he wants to find out who he is, but they, of course, want to take care of him by taking him out, so he needs to survive. And then there's the him saying, okay, now you've failed, so leave me alone. And they don't. And so now he's coming after them. And then the last one of them continuing to try to take him out, but him at the same time really trying to figure out what is going on and getting down to the crux of it to finally take them out. So it really is a trilogy. There's definitely more that this character can do, but that theme of him trying to find out who he is and bringing this small group of people within the government, the CIA, to a close in the influence that they're doing and him having to win so that they don't take him out has come to a close.
But there's definitely, as you said, more room. I mean, and this was such a successful financial success. I can't imagine that they won't keep going with this, I would think.
It's very much room. And Greg's a big fan of The Equalizer.
Yes.
Which is, I think we've talked about, although I don't think we've reviewed.
Not yet. It's like it was kind of a similar 80s spy show where this guy worked for an agency and he was, it's some similarities.
So there is the possibility, I don't know if they'll take that route, of doing something similar to The Equalizer where now he is free of the CIA, he has all his skills, how does he choose to utilize those skills?
Or is he really free? You know, that one of those
Well, that's true. There is the, if is he really free? But I might find that a little annoying if they do.
Yeah, I know.
But there is the possibility, right? He could just decide to go under and try to live his life as a normal human being, or he could decide to use his skills in some other way. If we don't know, we'll have to see if they do it.
A couple of things that are sort of noted features of these films, of the Bourne films. Number one, as all thrillers, all good spy thrillers have to be, it's very tightly plotted and very slickly put together. So the production value of figuring out how to put together these scenes and how to make them work together is extremely tight. Yeah.
Yes.
And the other part of it I would mention is that when you get to the fight scenes, there have been some people who have complained about the way that the fight scenes were done, and they were done the same way in this film as they were in the other films, where this camera is, it's a handheld camera, first of all, and it moves around quite a bit, and it's tight, close in on the action. So it's sometimes hard to see, you know, what's going on in any particular moment. It's not like one of those things where you're watching these two guys fighting in a room and it's a still camera.
So you can see the whole thing.
But I think, though, that to me, I think works very well for these movies, because part of the issue here is, and what makes this such a fascinating story to me, is that this guy, this one guy, is, you know, basically the entire government, more or less, is out to get him, right? The entire government, all of the resources of the government and all of their agents and all their people are trying to bring him down. There's some exceptions to that, but you know what I mean. Basically, there's a whole bunch of people who want to get rid of him. And he is the one person uniquely qualified to be able to resist them doing that because of how talented he is and how much ability he has. And in that sense, the fact that there's some kind of controlled chaos about the way he lives his life fits to me the way that they do these fight scenes as well. Like in Bourne Ultimatum, there is this unbelievable fight scene in Morocco with this guy, this other agent. And it's just, it's ridiculous. Like, it's an incredibly great fight scene, even though it's, you know, it's not always as clear as sort of what's going on. But I like that because I think that that contributes a more realistic feel to what's going on.
And that's where I was going to come in, is I think that when you see these fight scenes, they feel real.
Yeah.
When you have the camera angle a little bit back and you're seeing the whole scene and you're just watching it, it can lose that aspect of this being a real down nitty-gritty fight. When you see it from this perspective, you really are in it. And it really does feel real, and it's not pretty. It is, he is trained, but, you know, what he has to do is what he has to do. And then I also have to say, just for give a little more personal perspective, was it NYPD? There's some...
NYPD Blue?
Not even NYPD Blue. There was some TV show that came out where the camera was... It was famous because the camera moved all the time.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the... Well, I think NYPD Blue was one of the first ones to do that, yes.
It was the one... Is it Caruso that always has his hands on the...
Yes.
Okay. It was the one that he was in.
Yeah. That's NYPD Blue.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I actually... You know, I respected that, but I actually sometimes found it annoying. But in this instance, it's not all the time, and it's in certain instances... I didn't find it annoying in this. So I just want to make a note that if you are one of those people that's like, oh, I don't like it when the camera's all over the place, I don't think you'll be annoyed in this instance because it's only in certain instances and it really, it has a purpose.
Right.
But again, this movie has gotten a lot of great reviews because it is jam-packed full of a lot of great sequences. It has a lot of great fight scenes. It has what some people consider the best car chase up till now.
And what I like about it too is that it doesn't, it's a smart thriller. It doesn't condescend to its audience. It doesn't need to stop every 5 seconds and go, oh, here's what's happening. You know, you can get it, you know, because people are not always dumb.
We said the editing is tight and the pacing is good.
It's a smart thriller that assumes that you're smart enough
right
to follow it.
Yep.
And one of the other things I wanted to say was a lot of people have said that this is sort of the newer, hipper James Bond. You'll remember, longtime listeners to the show, that we reviewed Casino Royale. And what I was struck by watching this is there's no question to me that James Bond, in returning to its roots in Casino Royale, is also trying to return to direct competition with Bourne, because I think their sense is, my feeling is that Daniel Craig's James Bond is much closer to Jason Bourne
right.
than to, let's say, the original effete James Bond mm-hmm. with the martinis and the tuxedos and all that kind of stuff.
That's true.
I think that that's sort of getting close to a much more kind of hip spy and how they're going to deal with things in the year 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. And I never got the feeling. The other thing I wanted to say, this is a PG-13 film, and the violence is not, to me, is reasonable. It's not overboard. You know,
right.
it's PG-13, so you can't bring a 5-year-old to it, but you never get the feeling like it's overboard. Even though it's PG-13 and not R, the film still works and you don't feel
right.
as if it's somehow being limited or restricted by that,
right.
which I really liked quite a bit. I should mention as well, there's Julia Stiles is in this, and she's been all the other movies. She's in this a little bit more as well. She's okay. I mean, she's not unbelievable, but Matt Damon, actually, I really liked him in Good Will Hunting, but Matt Damon is really good in this role. He's mm-hmm. very confident, he's competent, he plays the role, and he's believable, and you get the mm-hmm. sense, I don't know about you, I really root for him. You feel like you want him to succeed.
There's depth and breadth to his character.
Yeah.
So yes, I know, I do think it's a good role for him.
Yeah, so I really, you know, so I like that. And one of the last cool thing I'll say about it is we saw it in a theater that was on East 71st Street,
mm-hmm.
and there was a building in the movie that supposedly is on 415 East 71st Street.
A very important building.
If you've
seen the movie, or if you see the movie, the most important building in the movie
yeah.
is supposedly right a block away from where we saw.
So we went down
movie.
And drove around, but it wasn't there. So it was a fake building. But we still thought it was cool. Or maybe we didn't see it. I thought it was cool, though.
It was nice.
And we were in one of those one movie only theaters,
right.
so this was the only film playing there.
Right.
This was there as well. So what do you want to say for The Bourne Ultimatum?
Okay, we're just rating this movie.
Yes.
8?
It's either an 8 or a 9.
Yeah.
See, I would have rated Bourne Identity 9. I would have rated Supremacy 8, and this either an 8 or a 9.
Yeah.
This is close to a 9, though.
Mm-hmm.
I almost want to give it a 9.
Okay.
I really like smart movies. I like it. By the way, that's the second movie in a row that Matt Damon has done, or the second movie, but it's another movie that he's done where they understand intelligence. Good Will
mm-hmm.
Hunting's another one where
mm-hmm.
they deal with intelligent people. So
mm-hmm.
good stuff. So Bourne Ultimatum, very, very good.
Yeah.
Highly recommended. Go see it. And you need to go see it soon because it's probably only going to be out for another week or so.
Yeah, we're really behind on this one. In some places, it might already be gone.
Yeah, so go check it out as soon as you can. It's also something I'm going to be looking forward to getting the DVD because I bet the behind-the-scenes stuff and how they made some of the stuff is going to going to be cool. So, okay. So a 9 out of 10 for The Bourne Ultimatum. Go see it. It's cool.
All right. We're going to end with our podcast sequence.
That's right, which is Amanda Banana, the Obsessive Dog Walker Video Podcast. Yes, do not adjust your television sets or radios or iPods. Right. That is what we said.
I just want to check really quick because there's a lot of valuables in there, and this is a celebrity, high-profile client. Like you said, we got to be very careful and make sure that it's locked.
I like the way you're thinking, but it's locked.
Okay, but I need to hear it. So what's the matter?
We just locked it.
Well, when you talk, I can't hear. So I this is really important to me.
You can't hear when I talk?
Yeah, I need to hear it. Like, I need to hear the song.
I could hear it. I could hear, but I could hear
I'm making
the
a
sound that the door was making.
Yeah.
Do you think, honestly, that Rain Taylor wants to be inside there in a half-drunken stupor listening to you playing with the doorknob?
I'm not playing with it. I'm totally, like, I have, like, a process here. This is really important to me. It takes care of all my anxiety for the day. I really feel like I get back and in control of everything when I do this. Would you just be quiet for just a
it
second?
It sounds like you're playing with his door.
I'm not playing with his door. Why don't you go to the car and I'll meet you? I just want to make sure.
I cannot in good faith leave you up here by yourself.
No, it's going to take a second if you just hold on. Just let me do this, please.
Okay, you got to stop this. Okay.
So www.amandabanana.net.
MICKEY. No, I'm just kidding.
She does two things on this website. She has the video podcast, which I think she is up to 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also has the...
She calls them Banana Diaries, which are these audio versions, and those, I think she has 9 of those. And those audio ones tend to run, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 minutes, and the video podcasts tend to run 4.5, 5, you know, 4, somewhere mm-hmm. in the 4 range for these things.
This is about dogs, taking care of dogs, dog walkers. It's dog themed.
Right.
And again, by obsessive dog walker, I presume she means obsessive compulsive,
yes.
i.e. she is an obsessive compulsive,
like,
and she is also a dog walker.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think she means to say she's an obsessive dog walker, like she can't stop walking dogs.
Although, you know, there may be an aspect of that too.
We watched
3 or 4 of the video episodes, and then we listened to a couple of the diaries to kind of get a sense of it. I'll say a couple things in the outset. First of all, I think that the, you know, quality, the video quality itself is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's reasonably well edited for what they're trying to communicate.
Yes.
And her character, if I could get a better feel for her character, I think her character is put together reasonably well because she is obsessive compulsive.
Like before you go there, I want to say she seems to have good acting ability. The other people that are in it seem to have good acting ability. So it's performed well. Going to the script and the overall plot is a different piece.
Right.
But the production, the editing, the performance aspects, I think, are all pretty good quality. But the actual overall product depends highly upon the underlying script and plot. And that's where I think it kind of falls a little short.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Do you want to say more about that?
No, well, it's just simply because I presume that this is supposed to be comical.
Right.
And
I hope so. I hope this is not a slice of life reality show. I mean,
right.
I hope
and it's not funny.
Yeah.
It's not funny. One scene, the most recent one, is about her checking and rechecking the doorknob before she feels comfortable to leave. Again, a comical idea, but not translated into a very funny performance.
In fact, I personally found it a little bit uncomfortable. You know, I was
it was a little bit awkward.
I was like, wow, well, that's really, so we're, it's like you're making fun of obsessive compulsive disorder. It wasn't that I was offended by it. It was just sort of like, yeah, awkward. There wasn't anything there that was making me go, ha, ha, ha. And I don't know if that's because that kind of humor, I don't like that kind of humor where you make fun of people with serious problems.
No.
I don't like that kind of humor or whether
it's
something
about...
Well, that
might be why you didn't like it.
I mean, it's part of it.
I have no issue making fun of people with issues, but the concept is...
Oh, you don't, do you?
No, I have absolutely no problem with it.
Okay,
I'm a social worker, so I get all of that, you know, karma, good karma. any
of you
that.
Who have just clicked on our episode like six times before you can listen to it, and then another six times afterwards, you can feel free to be offended by Clea.
Right, right.
Okay.
because, it's everything's fair game. The concept is, it's not funny to just say, I'm just going to check it. That's been done. We all understand the concept. Again, I can't really be specific enough to simply to say the dialogue and the jokes aren't there.
Yeah, and I also don't know.
And I don't think it's because they didn't perform it right. I don't think it's that they don't have comic timing. I think that just the script and plot
didn't provide
them comedy.
And the other thing I had, the other issue too, is I don't know what the heck is going on. Like, my sense is what are we putting together here? You know, if the idea is just to be, because they have this whole sequence of events where she has this rival dog walker that she's being trained by the person, and then she's walking around learning things with her. And so there's this one episode that we watched about doggy yoga, and this person is doing this dog, but I just was kind of like, what am I watching? I didn't get any sense of any coherency to it. I didn't get a sense of
concept, right? Them doing doggy yoga. But it doesn't.
Well, it doesn't work. But my point is larger than that. My point is that, number one, it is both not an episode arc that makes sense to me, nor is it like Seinfeld, where every episode is self-contained. It's some weird amalgam where I feel like I need to know about this Destiny person, but I watch the episodes and I feel as I'm watching them that I'm not getting any better understanding of how they relate to her.
Okay, well, one
she's
thing
just
I can
kind
agree
of
with
some
you
weird
on that
person
is that the
who
description
does weird things.
Of no? the episode, I don't think necessarily. Really explains it, like the doggy yoga thing. It talked about, you know, she's investigating into this awful thing that people do of
she says
doggy yoga, but that's not at all what the episode's about. It's right. Just her and this other woman teaching her doggy yoga.
Yeah,
and
the description says, I think there's a conspiracy underfoot. Why won't Animal Planet report on the cruelty facing our animals that is doggy yoga, etc., etc.? In this episode, Amanda Banana dons her dog wadding detective hat to delve more into the practice that is dog yoga. But no, though, that's not what the episode is at all. That's just them doing this yoga where they stretch out the legs of this whatever it is, not a chihuahua, but whatever the heck it is. And they, you know, and then they see a squirrel and it runs off and chases the squirrel and they're looking at each other. I just feel like I'm missing something here and I don't know what it is that I'm missing. I feel like there should be something here that's making this funny, but I just don't see it. As I say, the production value's there. I think the character is there, but I don't know where we're going with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't get any sense of where I'm supposed to be, what parts I'm supposed to laugh at and what not. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say.
Because the joke never comes. I mean, I think that's the it.
Yeah.
Is
yeah,
that she's
the joke?
checking in. And, I mean,
unless
a lot
you
of
just find people super awkward to be funny. But even that, it doesn't stay on awkward long enough for you to just find that funny if you would find it funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess they're just the punches aren't there.
Yeah, so.
I don't know exactly.
And this person seems like a very nice person, and we like the Hawk and Dove thing, but I mean.
I think all the talent is there except in the writing.
The script just needs to be written mm-hmm. differently, I guess, and you know, to for us to really get more out of it, I think. So uh-huh. What do you want to say for a rating?
Not so fast. You've asked me every single one.
I'd say a five.
What? You just said it wasn't funny and it wasn't successful.
Well, but it's because I think the production value is very good. No, I didn't say that. I said the production value is very good. I said the character's there. I just think the script is not there and it's not funny.
Well, the script is a major point.
Well,
and,
all right.
You know, I think, unfortunately, we have to give reviews that are honest, and no matter how talented and nice we think people are, I think this is a 3.
Oh, I don't think it's that bad. You think it's a 3?
I can't imagine.
And that's not a 3.
Think watching about this and wanting to watch it again.
No, that's too strong.
Okay.
It's not. It can't be a 3 because
4.
Think about the things that we reviewed that have been, you know, sort of down and that have been in that ballpark. You know, things like the wrong of the right, and that kind of thing, where the person is it worse than that? I mean, here you have people who actually know how to edit together film, who know how to, you know, get together enough dogs to make something of an episode every week. I mean, my sense is if you say the talent's there and the, you know, whatever's there, it's hard to give that a 3.
Okay, 4.
I mean, I would have said
okay, 5.
I mean, I don't want to force you into it. If you want to do a 4, we'll do a 4. But
5,
know.
Fine. 5.
Okay. So a 5, and as I say, it seems like a nice person. Website seems to work out well, but there's just something about
the
show.
The buffering takes a little while.
Yeah, the downloading takes a little bit while. It takes a while to do, that's true. But just something about the show itself just doesn't seem that funny to us, and that's kind of...
It's just the script. It's
the script. So, so the script needs to be worked on, basically, is the moral of the story, I guess I'd say. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. We didn't say anything about the diary. again, the diary was, I don't know if this is just, this is her kind of a workshop working through a character or something like that, like just character development, because she really is, there's a lot of material here, but again, no jokes.
Yeah, it just doesn't, so it's be leading up to a punchline that doesn't come.
Yeah, the diary is about the same way. It's just kind of her, like, monologuing. And again, it's all quite real, but
not funny. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's her goal, then, I mean, if that's not her goal, then, you know, it's that changes things.
All right, so we're going to say 5 out of 10 for the Amanda Banana Obsessive Dog Walker Video Podcast, Joe.
Okay.
All right, that's going to do it for us for this week. We want to thank everyone for submitting stuff for review. We want to encourage you to keep doing that. We want to encourage you to keep listening. Please spread the word. Please call into our line. Please email. Please do all that cool kind of stuff. And most of all, please keep being the wonderful people that you all are. Right?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Okay. In that case, upon further review, I'm Greg.
I'm Clea.
See you next week.
The proceeding was a presentation of Upon Further Review, hosted at www.furtherreview.net. As usual, all rights are reserved. If you liked what you heard, please vote for us at podcastalley.com, vitalpodcast.com, and add us to your list of favorites at podcastpickle.com. You can leave us a comment at www.furtherreview.net, drop us a line at upon@furtherreview.net, or give us a phone call or send a fax to 206-339-UFR1. That's 206-339-8371. And lastly, don't be afraid to express your opinions. We know you have them. Let them out. Feel the power. Or you could just blindly accept whatever we tell you is fact. That'll work.
Bravo!
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good, though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
Get him away!
Hey, boo!
Boo!